Kia ora, welcome comrades to Where's My Jetpack, a politics and pop culture podcast with sci-fi and socialist leanings. I'm Ani White.
Derek Johnson, back finally after a lot of technical difficulties.
This month we are talking about dodgy beliefs that we've held, so our sort of dark past in terms of our beliefs. Derek, before we get into that, do you have any recs?
Yes. This one is very good. I definitely recommend this one and see where you fit on the chart that's been made on conspiracies. This is called My Conspiracy Childhood / Weird Junk I Believe by Emma Thorne on YouTube. She makes skeptic videos about debating flat earthers and evolution and against people who don't think the dinosaurs are real. She also does pretty good videos debunking multi-level marketing scams, pyramid schemes. I'd also like to recommend the Anarcho-Capitalism and the Truth about Michael Malice by Chill Goblin. I kept seeing things about this guy, Michael Malice, because he kept popping up on different podcasts, but I started noticing that he's on a lot of reactionary and dark web, or whatever these people call themselves, the dark intelligence, whatever the fuck they call themselves, kind of shows. And I was like, wait a minute, why is an anarchist talking with, you know, all these different Crowder and people on Shapiro's channel? And this guy's an anarcho-capitalist, but he very cleverly never says anarcho-capitalism. And I think we finally come to a point where even anarcho-capitalists are so ashamed and embarrassed by the label, and I would too, since most people know that debates on the subject devolve into arguing about age of consent pretty quickly, as I would say. And they've come to a point where calling yourself an anarchist, as fringe as that is in American politics, that they would rather call themselves anarchists. So it seems like a bit of a scheme. He's undertaking a project to steal the term anarchist for the right. Don't want to use anarcho-capitalism or minarchism, etc. And they're so unpopular. I'm looking at this in the context also of this documentary on HBO Max that Blumhouse Films produced about the anarcho-puco people, all those hedge fund and Bitcoin schemers and pyramid scheme guys. They're trying to make it look like these people are anarchists, and this is why anarchism fails. These people are anarcho-capitalists, and what is the difference between that and a left anarchist, a social libertarian, etc.? I find it very interesting, the timing, as people are stepping away from traditional politics as global fascism rising. You know, people are very angry and unionizing, that I think it's a good time to always take out the stick and whack the anarchists again, like a pinata. And part of the anti-left part of Chomsky's propaganda model, this kind of way of attacking anti-capitalism, just so nobody goes any further to blaming the system, not just like a shitty boss or shitty corporations or Elon Musk or something. I half jokingly say this, but you know, there's some evidence for this for some shareholders meetings. The Warner Brothers shareholders really did not like that V for Vendetta masks were adopted by the Occupy Wall Street protesters. They really hated that. You look at a lot of the different projects like Batman, the last Batman one that Nolan did, Beware the Batman, Dark Knight Rises, right? Beware the Batman had Anarchy as the villain, who was based on V, and had Anarchy as the villain and his army, the Arkham games, Arkham Knight. And then also recently, if you watched The Batman, there was a Joker gang too that was very interesting in this light. So we keep seeing this coming time and again, and as well in Joker. You had the Joker masks by all the anti-capitalists. Warner Brothers seems to have this bug up its ass to get revenge for those V masks being used during Occupy Wall Street. So I just wanted to bring this documentary, quote unquote, you know, to people's attention. Because it looks like the scammers got killed by maybe some cartels or somebody.
I've encountered this thing of anarcho-capitalists just calling themselves anarchists. Like, I remember I was looking around at various political podcasts, and founder, one that called itself an anarchist podcast. I can't remember the specific one now. They were talking about Black Lives Matter, and they sort of started advocating for people paying for essentially militias instead of having like a state-funded police force. And I was like, yeah, I can't see how the fact that it's mainly wealthy white people who've benefited from all of the system, I can't see how possibly use private militias to, you know, reinforce white supremacy. Like the idea that having a privatized police force would somehow solve the issue of racialized capitalism.
Yeah, I don't think the police not being mercenaries was the problem. It's almost like, you know what we haven't had enough of in American history? The Pinkertons.
Look at who owns the capital. You know, what would they use it for? It would just be what we have, but worse kind of thing.
Yeah, and you look at a lot of the cop watchers that are libertarians, that's what their end goal is. They want to discredit the state police, but that through cop watching, but then they ultimately they want to justify and advocate for private police. And that's minarchism. So that's pretty shitty because, you know, there's a lot of left-wing people who do cop watching. And, you know, that goes back to the Black Panthers, the ones that started that. Yeah. I think one of the worst things that came out of Black Lives Matter is the cameras that the cops wear. When people made a demand of that, I was like, careful what you wish for, because I don't think that is a very good demand that the cops wear cameras. Because now what that does is that the cops can just get everything you do on camera and edit it, or they just destroy the cameras if they get caught doing something. Because basically for Uvalde in Texas, with those cops let all those kids get slaughtered, they basically hired an expensive law firm to block the FOIA requests of all the families so that they couldn't see the cops' cameras when those really should be released to the public. They don't want to be seen, you know, just standing around twiddling their thumbs, you know?
Talked about bad anarchist or anarcho-cap bullshit, however we want to phrase it, but someone I'd recommend as a better anarchist source, and not even an anarchist myself, but very sympathetic to it, is Zoe Baker's YouTube channel. So Baker's, as I say, an anarchist, and the videos are very educational. So it includes archival documentaries, like one I enjoyed was Free Voice of Labor, The Jewish Anarchists. She does shorter original material. One was called Bakunin Was a Racist, which has obviously a fairly polemical title, but it kind of works to separate the libertarian socialist baby from the anti-Semitic bathwater. Mm-hmm. Bakunin's work as obviously a foundational 19th century anarchist. And there was also a video which was part of the inspiration for this episode, My Dark Past, Silly Things I Believe, in which Baker admits to being a former MRA or men's rights activist, among other dirty laundry.
That surprises me.
Yeah, that surprises me too, but I guess it just goes to show, you know, nobody starts where they are now kind of thing. Like you meet someone in their 30s. You've been through quite a lot. Most people aren't raised as libertarian communists.
Who started the quote, you're like a liberal when you're young, you become a conservative when you're old, or somebody said that? Or Buckley liked to say it too, I know.
I also confuse socialist and liberal, so they'll be like, if you're not a liberal before you're 20, you have no heart. If you're not something else after, you have no brain. That whole thing, yeah. The kernel of truth there comes from the complete lack of familiarity that a lot of essentially like middle class white people have with political theory. So they'll go from kind of a very moralistic kind of left liberal leaning to then sort of encountering capitalism, then they'll be like, well, I understand the real world now. And they didn't encounter like an actual serious critique of capitalism along the way.
Yeah, it's like, no, you don't understand the real world now. You just are fine with the status quo and with the current level of exploitation.
Because of people's like surface level impression of what left-wing politics are, it's so shallow, it becomes easy to dismiss. People think that in order to be truly anti-capitalist, you shouldn't use any commodities, for example. And then people will be like,
why do you use an iPhone, man?
Exactly. And like, to those of us who are sort of familiar with a serious critique of capitalism, that seems very silly, but it's a very widespread conception of anti-capitalism.
It's very puritanical, and I hate to break it to anybody, but everything's bad under capitalism, even good things that could be possibly potentially good. And that's why I'm against nuclear power, for instance. Nuclear power could possibly be done right, but I would say under capitalism, not a fucking chance.
Well, that's a can of worms. Probably stay away from that one for now. So, on to dodgy things with belief. Derek, do you want to start?
For me, as a mixed person of color, different sides of my family being Black and Italian and Irish and everything, for me, I was able to mostly pass, especially all I had to do was like keep my mouth shut. And that's a weird feeling. It's part of your American racial experience. And for me, it was hell in this country and at school. So for me, that made me a bit of a hotep. And
for the uneducated, explain hotep.
Well, I was a very reactionary, Afrocentric, Pan-Africanist, kind of like Nation of Islam, Garveyist kind. I understand all of the lyrics to the Wu-Tang Clan and Nas songs because I understand a lot of his politics.
The nationalist sort of references on them and that.
Those are the 5% nation of gods and man, yeah. There's a big difference between Black nationalism in America versus white nationalism, because that's white supremacy. Because Black nationalism is about, still about, you know, enslaved group of diaspora within the United States. And that's a very different thing to break away and try to have more freedom and liberation as a liberatory movement or a liberation movement. Even at my angriest, I don't think I've ever been like a separatist or anything. But, you know, it goes back to that joke. I mean, you can see it all as far as back as like the most radical person is the most light-skinned. And that is true in the Black community. I will cop to that. Well, I think it's a how you're treated kind of thing and how you internalize and how you externalize race in this country, and the fact that your ancestors were owned and that your last name was the last name of people who owned your ancestors. Other people in this country don't have that history. I would say the only thing that kept me out of being a Nation of Islam is probably being mixed and learning about Malcolm X and how he embraced Sunni Islam and got away from the cult. And that, you know, the more I learned about that kind of stuff and the more I learned about how Nation Islam's a cult and the kooky things that they really believe that comes out of Black Freemasonry. Some of the ideas that Elijah Muhammad put into the group was a lot of pyramid scheme type stuff and multi-level marketing stuff, because that's why a lot of continuing Nation of Islam people are involved in a lot of MLMs and often in cahoots with Scientologists who are kind of finally feeling the heat now. Both groups are working together, but you never would have thought that Farrakhan and the Scientologists were in cahoots. Seeing the hypocrisies, seeing the homophobia, and definitely, I would say, culturally as a Catholic and as somebody in that, in the Black diaspora and from my own family, I would say that I had internalized that homophobia and had homophobic ideas or trends towards culture and things. And that's why I find it so strange that people so young are like attacking Disney and things and culture and gay people now. And they're like Zoomers or something, or young millennials, and they're like, don't like the LGBT community. And it's just like, to me, it feels anachronistic. We went through all this shit in the 80s and 90s, and with gay marriage, everybody pretty much moved the Overton window. The Black community moved over on gay marriage and gay acceptance once Obama accepted gay marriage. That was like, you could write a whole book on that. It's been much better. Rap is getting better. Hip hop is getting better in that regard.
Have you read James Baldwin's stuff on Elijah Muhammad, going back to Elijah Muhammad? Because he's really interesting in that he kind of understands what they're selling and why it's appealing.
I can imagine. I haven't read it. I've read some Baldwin, but I haven't read him writing on that. But I could imagine exactly what he would have said about it.
Because obviously he understands the value of like of Black self-love and all that, though coming from a perspective of someone who's excluded by being gay from the Nation of Islam. It's a very nuanced account. much anything from him in the sense that he knows where to draw the line, but he also has a very complex understanding of people and what makes people tick. So he talks about why what they're selling is appealing.
Most Muslims in this country are African American, and something that, you know, missed in demographics and by media and culture and everything, that everybody thinks that it's just somehow, oh, there's just the only Muslims are just happening now. And there's new Arab and Middle Eastern North African people who are Muslims coming here as immigrants. There's people who have been Muslim living in this country preceding this being a nation, that have been living here in the colonies, and the whole area of New York where they were going to make the so-called the 9/11 mosque that the Islamophobes were shitting themselves over. That area used to be called Little Syria back in like the 30s or 20s, I think, because the density of people from the Middle East that immigrants to that area of Far East Side.
So you had your Hotep players.
Once I learned really about how full of shit and hateful Nation of Islam was, and Farrakhan, I think it's pretty safe to say his role and Elijah Muhammad's role in the assassination of Malcolm X, along with the Red Squad in Chicago's police and the FBI's COINTELPRO, you know, everybody worked together and had a nice little consequence there and conclusion for all parties involved. You know, the whole thing was, it was only Islamic in as much as he merged pseudo-Islamic beliefs out of Sunni Islam and stuff that came from the North African guys that wore the fezes and the Shriners and the Black Islam, Black Freemason stuff. They came out of this. But what he did was he took the more Muslim flavor to make it sound like just another branch of Islam, which it wasn't technically and isn't considered by Muslims.
Yeah, obviously that was a big part of Malcolm X breaking away, was, as you said, of actual Islamist practice.
Yeah, and if the more you look into it, it has really fringe beliefs that carried over. If you really look into some really crazy speeches by Farrakhan, you'll hear him talking about the Jewish motherships and his ring ships in space, and this idea that this mad scientist Yacoub invented white people.
Yeah, it's syncretic culty stuff, like, really. Like, that's what it comes down to, is the sort of syncretic stuff.
What got me, too, was that the Nation of Islam, after Henry Ford, was the main and continued publishers of the International Jew and the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, I think, English language. If you take some of the International Jew and stuff, some of the anti-Semitic writing in there is the origins of a lot of Black people in the Black community believing that Jews sold them into slavery. And that was something that was cooked up by anti-Semites, so that, blame it on the Jews, not white people, not Portuguese and British and Americans doing the North Atlantic slave trade, you know, blame it all on the Jews. That's a book that they've spread in the Black community, and that caused a lot of dissension and distrust after and during civil rights movement, which the Jewish people helped a lot in, and the union movements, which Jewish people, Jewish communists especially, helped a lot in. Nation of Islam played a big role in driving a lot of those anti-Semitic, anti-gay, etc. wedges. They are Black capitalists. A lot of them have breakaway people, have started some new Black Panther groups in name only, who have even violently attacked veteran Black Panthers. They have a 10-point plan that isn't even anti-capitalist. I'm glad to be completely way out of that milieu so long ago in my life. When I still see it popping up again and again now, I really shudder and shake my head, you know. The Uhurus and the Black Hammer deal that just happened, they're getting raided by the FBI because of them doing propaganda for the Russians and shit like that. And the dead body over at the Black Hammer house, their cult leader, getting in some trouble. I kind of moved away from some of that. See, in my family, I was in my parents' mixed marriage. My parents had to pick like which religion I was going to be raised as. Just said, oh, fuck it, you know, Catholic. Like, my mom was a major in art history and comparative religions and shit like that in college. So she really put upon me choosing your own spiritual beliefs, choosing your own religion, and trying out the different churches when you go. I finally decided to go back at a point through my confirmation and all that. Even as a Catholic, though, I was pro-choice, though pro-death penalty, which no longer. Definitely not be an abolitionist, even though I hated cops and knew prison was bullshit and didn't reform anybody. I was not presented with any alternatives at the point. Same thing with drugs, you know, I was like, eh, okay, I could see that drug dealing and drug was a problem. And addiction, you know, okay, that is a problem. But I've slowly come to become a drug legalizer. I think once you go through the DARE program that we have here and you see how full of shit it was, and the scaremongering and stuff on pot and stuff, it actually does the worst thing possible. You take the small stuff and everything, and I would say it becomes a gateway to drinking and harder drugs. Because you figured, well, pot's actually not as bad as I was scared to think it was. Maybe I should try cocaine. Maybe I should try alcohol, since our whole culture says alcohol is fine. Or smoking cigarettes, right. You know?
But like how bad sex education results in actually unsafe sexual practices kind of thing.
Exactly. I had reasonable and normal sex ed, and then afterwards we had the focusing on abstinence first, not necessarily abstinence only, in the sex ed, and it's pretty bad. But we're not as bad as Texas. The way the parents are freaking out now, like the kids are being told too much, they've always had really good waivers and abilities to know what their kids are going to be taught and to opt out, that it's not age appropriate. I even remember at the different grade levels, they told us stuff that was grade and age level appropriate for what we understood for sex ed. So I would say the only bad thing is they gave us dodgy beliefs, obviously, on homosexuality and AIDS and abstinence and stuff.
Fortunately, I had a very liberal sex education. Discount it. The only time I wasn't at a liberal school was before I was even doing sex ed. That's one thing.
I find it very funny. As a late baby gay here, a baby queer, coming out in my late 30s, early 40s as a pansexual, I realized through my sex ed classes, they didn't teach us shit about being gay and gay sex and everything. And I found it so radically frustrating and interesting that one of the best things written on it came out of the surprisingly radical and anti-capitalist online version of Teen Vogue. They had a whole article on how to properly have anal sex and be safe and everything. It was just blew my mind. And we're just moving backwards as a country. And it just, wait, why? Now that I'm gay, everything's going backwards? What?
Yeah, we had a schools out a queer support group at the high school I went to, and they spoke at least once at sex ed classes, and you could have like anonymous questions. I believe I did ask them an anonymous question about anal. Yeah, not really surprising that that's often one of the first things people have questions about.
No, it should be, because I tell you what, in the Bible Belt, and especially for born-agains and for Catholics, they get it in their heads that as long as they do anal, the girls get to stay virgins and it don't count. And that's caused a lot of problems. Had a lot of outbreaks of gonorrhea and stuff. We're at the point in Florida where we actually have a drug untreatable gonorrhea because of bad sex ed and everything, you know? You know, that's what, as far as back as I remember. And it wasn't such a radical in the way it's being used now. You're woke. It was just that you kind of understood how things work. You could see systems, mostly. You understood how America really is, or about race, about the police, about politics, about money, etc. But the problem is that as long as you're still a liberal, I think, or as long as you're still capitalist or whatever, your framing will keep you trapped and be a little more reactionary. So like when you're black nationalist, but you have no analysis of capitalism and the anti, you know, you fall for like black capitalism, or just buy black. So you find some of these kind of pitfalls, kind of get you sucked into these reactions you're in, then keep you from kind of expanding, you know, your knowledge base, learning more. So sometimes you end up still being more homophobic or misogynist. Because, I mean, when you look at racism, when you look at it right, you look at it as akin to critical race theory or actual critical race theory, where it's institutional, and this country was built on slavery, and nothing has changed in that regard, except for overt racism. And yeah, most of redlining has changed, but not totally. Not all of the lending stuff has went away from banks. Problem is, though, is that when you're in this frame, you think it's the white people. So you're like, you hate whitey. Kill whitey. Let's be away from whitey. Don't have white friends. Don't have white lovers. And where you make it into a personal thing. And I think that's one of those traps where you think it's just the other people that's the problem. No, it was the institutions of capitalism, slavery, et cetera, the state. Hmm. As woke as I was, you know, I still had to since read and learn a lot to really get beyond that political adolescence. And I think a lot of people are in those different stages. And I think, you know, you go long enough, you maybe move more to the left in whatever way on different issues. And the way I always look at it as, you know, like they say in the cliche and what the right always fear mongers. Yeah, when you go to college, you will expand a lot of your thinking socially, politically, historically. The only thing I would say is stay away from poli-sci class, because political science makes you pretty reactionary and centrist and makes you accept the status quo. Because really, if you look at the academy, there really isn't a lot of good Marxist theory.
Yeah, and when there is, you often don't have access to it at an undergrad level. Like, there's a huge gap between undergraduate and postgraduate level in terms of the degree of depth of the study. I mean, one thing I say about undergraduate is you have a wide breadth of study, but often a very shallow depth of study. Well, speaking of superficial understandings of things, just to make a segue, I think it's interesting to talk about, when we talk about dodgy things we believe, there's the general just set of things that we might be raised with, but we tend to be talking mostly about all the sort of the most weird crank things we flirted with along the way. Like, you talked about it as traps, you know, it's almost like the potholes that once we've set off on our journey, we fall into. And one of mine was certainly teenage libertarianism. So,
oh boy. This I have to hear.
Yeah. I will just put in the disclaimer that obviously prior to being a teenager, I had all sorts of dodgy ideas that, you know, basic racist ideas or sexist ideas that most people are taught in society. I had a relatively liberal upbringing, but even so. But this is one of the first kind of potfalls I had on setting out on my course of learning more about the world and beginning to question the world was, so teenage libertarianism. I think it's probably quite a common young white kind of libertarianism that I sort of went through. It was a flirtation. I was never fully committed, and I simply never understood political theory well enough to be a really committed.
She never got into Ayn Rand though, right?
No, but so what I did think though for a period was that all the state should do is stop violent crime, you know, people killing and that, things like that, and should not regulate in any other sphere of life. I did believe in that. Obviously, now I can say, well, okay, so the state sucks, but should we really have unemployment without any kind of protection from the consequences of it?
And where does crime come from? Define crime.
Yes, there's all sorts of critiques that I have now. But at the time, it seemed to make sense to me because I think at that point I was queer and I knew that I was queer. So for one thing, that was one thing that I actually understood about the world was that the state regulating sort of consensual relationships between people was bad. So that was one thing I was like, okay, I understand that, like, that regulating consensual relationships between adults is a bad thing. I hadn't really thought about economics at all, really, like, not in any serious way. I hadn't thought about class. I hadn't thought about how capitalism actually works. I mean, I just had a very shallow sort of take on all of that.
Well, not that it's a competition, but so you probably were anti-drug war, pro-consenting adults being able to put in their body whatever they wanted, than I probably might have been. Depending.
What a lot of it hinged on was exactly that I was pro-drug legalization, I was pro-no kind of prohibitions on queerness. Like, I had all the sort of positions that you'd basically share between liberals, libertarians, and any good leftist, you know, the general kind of call social liberalism, you know, that there shouldn't be prohibitions on people's rights around sex or drugs or what have you. That I was all good on, but I just didn't have a serious analysis of economics, and my understanding of power was pretty shallow. There was almost a bit of South Park in me.
South Park conservative, South Park Republican.
Yeah, and it was that time, like this was the early noughties, like I was into Trey and Matt. So recently I actually saw a picture of Trey and Matt going to Oscars around that time in drag while apparently tripping. So, you know, there was a fierce appeal to that. It felt countercultural at the time, you know. I had a shallow understanding of power. Mm-hmm. I had a shallow understanding of economics, but I understood that the state regulating things like stopping people from engaging in consensual sexual relationships, and that was bad. So I think much like what you said about that, you had an understanding that racism was bad, that the USA had screwed over black people en masse, but then, you know, there were some other things you hadn't properly thought about.
Yeah, it was homophobic, but didn't think it should be illegal or that people should be punished. Because in the same way that I was pro-choice, I definitely had ideas of other people have different beliefs, live and let live. And it was kind of that way to a degree with drugs, but it was kind of like, well, you get arrested for doing drugs, you brought that on yourself, you know, that kind of conservatism, just world fallacy. So I would say in that regard, which of us had the worst belief? You had that probably at the appropriate time in your life. Let's see. So I would say maybe believing in Bigfoot and Nessie in the third grade. You think that might be bad?
What is third grade? Age you third grade?
And aliens and Roswell and shit.
8, right. Okay, I was into conspiracy theories at that age as well. I was into aliens. I was into X-Files, alien abduction.
No, X-Files did not help. And I was in junior high in high school when that came out.
So that's an earlier one. I was into conspiracy theories, but I was much like with you. I think I was too young to even really count that. I read some alien abduction books, but it was like pretty much on the level of, well, I had an imaginary friend a couple of years earlier, you know. You're not even on your way towards becoming an adult.
Yeah. Was the age of reasons like 7 years old? Whatever.
I think we can probably reasonably start around like 13 years of age in terms of dodgy things you believed, because otherwise it's like there's an endless sea of things that you probably don't even remember you believed, you know, because early 20s is about when your brain sort of hits the point where it's not going to develop much more, which doesn't mean you're not going to learn much more, but like your cognitive faculties are basically in place that are going to be there.
Could you imagine if adults believed in Santa Claus? Now, why do we recognize that, but then religion, we don't think about that?
You'd have to really rationalize a lot of things out of existence, but considering the amount of adults who do that and are conspiracy theorists, I'm sure it would be possible. I'm sure people could convince themselves that there's a conspiracy to hide the truth about Santa Claus. And now that we've found that it must exist somewhere on the internet.
We live in an infinite multiverse, so now it popped into one of those Earths.
There's a dodgy belief I apparently still hold as some kind of strange causative relationship that my thoughts have with, as you say, the multiverse. Getting a little surprise.
New agey stuff bleeds into things, and sometimes you have kind of new age beliefs that kind of sneak in, and I think those are dodgy things that you kind of have to kick in your life, because you recognize that, like with conspiracy theories, of the logical fallacies and the reactionary underpinnings of those ideas and where they come from. Because, you know, you look at the history of New Age stuff, you read up on Wilhelm Reich and his takes on fascists and mysticism, you'll stop being New Age real fast. And you see these connections that certain magical thinking has to fascism and reactionary thought and racism and stuff, you know. It's like, as fun as conspiracy theories were back in X-Files, it's hard to enjoy shows and things that have conspiracies, like that cartoon on Netflix and others. and Gravity Falls, Inside Jobs, like QAnon ruined it all. If you really look at most conspiracy theories, the ones that are about controlling cabals and stuff, I mean, those are just new versions of either Illuminati stories spread by monarchists and stuff during the revolutions during the 17 and 1800s, or it's re-updates of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and most Jewish conspiracies like Hitler's Jewish Bolshevism and what's now called Cultural Marxism as the offshoot of that. Far-right neo-Nazis believe, you know.
When I watch those kinds of shows, like Inside Job, which for people who don't know is essentially about the conspirators, like an office comedy about the conspirators who are in on all the various conspiracies that are actually true.
They work at the deep state, yeah.
I have to compartmentalize. It's like watching Brooklyn Nine-Nine prior to Season 8, because Season 8, by the way, if people don't know, actually deals quite well with the aftermath of the George Floyd uprising and consequences that obviously had for the writers thinking about writing a cop show. But prior to Season 8, enjoying Brooklyn Nine-Nine, you kind of have to compartmentalize. If you have like a structural critique of the police, you kind of have to be like, okay, this is a sitcom, it's dumb fun, it's got nothing to do with real cops, and like just switch off that part of your brain and enjoy it as a sitcom.
Yeah, Mike Myers' Pentaveret really undercut and kind of had a good counter-programming answer to conspiracy theories and stuff.
Watching shows where conspiracy theories are real, I kind of have to switch off the part of my brain that says, this could be playing to some really dodgy pit thinking and people out there who actually buy into this stuff, and just be like, this is just funny. Like, there's an element of like compartmentalizing and being like, I'm just going to enjoy this on its own terms and have a bit of escapism and switch off that part of my brain a little bit. Do a similar kind of compartmentalizing to what I do with propaganda. Because with propaganda, it's like, how much of media is not propaganda? How much media actually has a structural critique of the police force?
The Wire is about it.
You're looking at maybe one or two examples that are like accessible to most people of like media texts that are like that. It's just, there's not really much of an alternative. So you kind of have to accept that if you're going to enjoy pop culture, you're going to be enjoying stuff that has a bit of propaganda.
Yeah, cops are protagonists. I mean, even with X-Files, you have the two heroes are FBI agents.
Yeah, or benevolent, or I won't say what this is, but in order to not spoil it, but I watched something the other day that had a bad cop, and because it had the bad cop in it, I was like, oh, this is going in a really interesting direction. But they very specifically absolved the rest of the police force in the last act, and that was like, ugh, you know, it was like such a disappointment because the rest of it was so good.
Yeah, the Shield was like in the vein of Sopranos, and it wimped out in the end and just made it like, we just need dirty cops, do the shit that people want. I mean, it's just make Dirty Harry argument all over again, you know. You didn't break new ground, buddy.
Yeah, on the topic of my teenage libertarianism, I did actually end up arguing with a Maoist a lot online, and he was a very specific kind of Maoist. Like, I don't really agree in retrospect with almost anything that he said, but it was enough of a challenge to my own ideas that I started to see some of the oversights in what I was thinking.
So you saw that you were both wrong?
Yes, well, at least I saw that I was wrong. Like, I saw that my ideas didn't really stack up when it came to capitalism, essentially. Like, it took me a while to come around to being a Marxist. I definitely saw that my ideas didn't stack up when it came to capitalism. Like, I just hadn't really thought in any serious way about capitalism. Again, I don't really agree with everything in retrospect, but he did at least challenge enough of my preconceptions that I sort of stepped away from that. And I think I kind of went back to being a fairly standard left liberal. Like, that was my default setting before that, and it became my default setting after that, was kind of left liberal. I'm sure there's people that accuse me of still being left liberal. Kind of a straightforward default setting. It's like chaotic good. It just seems intuitively obvious to me.
Yeah, because, you know, I was always very socially liberal no matter what. I just seemed like that to be on different quadrants on the different issues. So, like, with immigration, I was like trying to think about this when coming up with this show. You know, I was always pretty liberal on immigration because, I mean, half my family didn't have the choice to come here. The other half came here when this was an open border and, you know, proud immigrants. So I was like, I don't give a shit how people get here. Yeah, I found that hard to judge. I found it hard to judge on anybody how they get here. It's just like everybody's got a different story.
I guess I've forgotten something. I don't recall myself ever being particularly anti-immigrant either. Unless this isn't already obvious, I guess the thing to keep in mind about my background is that I'm very much background of urban educated liberal, like that broadly speaking. Family background. A lot of things just seem kind of obviously not a big deal to me.
But it could be pointed out to you that you're a colonist and a colonizer or descendant of colonizers. I don't have that same background to my respective country, except for the native indigenous population. They were genocided and dropped as potential slaves so they could bring my ancestors from Africa here too, and a lot of intermarriage with Native Americans and the different tribes and Africans. But then again, too, there was a lot of slavery too. I know the Cherokee had black slaves. Most of the nation of the Seminoles, a lot of that is people who fled out of slavery, joined into the tribe.
In any case, I had a fairly superficial take on colonization. I mean, it was very standard liberal, bicultural. I supported the sort of the treaty process, but I, again, hadn't really thought through structural power, like how these things actually structurally affect people. Didn't really actively engage in learning about anything. I didn't actively engage in learning about my country's history. Mm-hmm. I didn't take the opportunity to learn Te Reo Māori, the Māori language, at high school level. That didn't interest me. So I had a very superficial engagement of that, where I saw that colonization was a bad thing, but I had no real in-depth kind of critique of its ongoing impact, and took me a number of years to be sufficiently challenged to begin to examine that kind of more default setting stuff, default kind of white liberal setting. Through university, I sort of flirted with the Labour Party, in fact, which is very much a fully fledged neoliberal party in this country. It's still in the sort of third way kind of Blair kind of vein. The funny thing is, I was attending Young Labour events around the same time as I first started attending sectarian Marxist events, and I got recruited eventually to a Marxist sect. So there was a period where I was kind of flirting basically with either a social democracy or Marxism, and the idea of like essentially somehow achieving social democracy through the Labour Party. I was young, and it was actually the sect that was courting me at the time, or be more accurate, I was courting it. They weren't like actively seeking me out individually, but they were actually studying Rosa Luxemburg's Reform or Revolution. That was one of the first really serious political texts that had a really big impact on me, would be Rosa Luxemburg's Reform or Revolution. It was being studied as a study group. So like week by week, we'd go through each chapter and discuss them. It was, as I say, first serious political text that had a really big impact on me, and it completely pulled me off the Labour Party path. As much as I'm critical of the sect Marxist model, it did kind of show to me how political education can be if you actually spend some time on the topic, you spend some time discussing it. You don't just like skim through one text a week. You take a text and you read it week after week and you discuss it in depth and like go into any questions people might have. And like I found the sect model of political education was actually a lot more stimulating than the university model of political education.
Yeah. I have a question about like the difference in how they taught in your country. Civics. We had a pretty good, about ninth grade, had a pretty good one semester. It was on U.S. government, and the other was on teaching government, the different ways that it worked here, and the history was come together with like the Constitution and all that stuff in a more practical level. You had more of a civics class. I've noticed that a lot of people in a lot of parts of the country, they don't even get that kind of a once a year bare bones civics government class, you know? Did you kind of have that kind of thing?
I mean, we wouldn't have even called it civics. I'm trying to think of the class that it would have been taught under, because we did have classes that addressed those things, but I never really learnt in any depth about my country's electoral system until university, until like I just happened to take an interest in that among other topics. Yeah, but there were classes that addressed it. I'm trying to think what they were called, because it wasn't civics.
Sometimes they covered stuff in geography, social studies.
Maybe social studies might have been, but in any case, there were classes that taught us about our electoral system, but never in any real depth. It was skimmed over.
Yeah, I got a really good class that really taught about the tripartite government and all that kind of stuff. That stuck, you know, so I understand when I'm watching the news and at C-SPAN and stuff, that I've always been able to get, you know, the votes and stuff.
My country's electoral system, which is MMP, mixed member proportional, that was actually, learning about the history of that was actually a big step in my political education, because basically what the reason MMP was brought in was because Labour was the first party to seriously introduce neoliberalism to this country. So they were the first government to, this is the fourth Labour government, to basically bring a deregulation of a lot of industries, commercialization of a lot of industries. They didn't quite get to smashing the unions. That was the next national government that smashed the unions. They started to privatize education, and you know, well, they brought in the student loan system, so student debt,
got it down to a science.
Yeah, so they brought in a lot of those kind of reforms, and so of course they lost a lot of their base. Then national came in, like the Labour government essentially collapsed. National came in, smashed the unions, brought in what was called the mother of all budgets, which was like attacking welfare and things. So in the space of maybe less than 10 years, a lot of the serious neoliberal reforms happened. Also during that time, there was a process of basically the revising the country's electoral system. There was a referendum over the country's electoral system, and people overwhelmingly flocked to MMP, mixed member proportional, which is, again, it's a proportional system, and it basically means the two major parties have less sort of inbuilt power. It means that third parties, because it's a proportional system, it means that third parties have more room and to form coalition governments and that. And the fact that if you read the analysis of voter motivation and that during that period, basically all the faith in the two major parties had collapsed, you know, by the base of party had lost faith. So there was this rush, this huge surge of support for a proportional system, because basically people didn't believe in the major parties.
Yeah, the neoliberal parties don't seem to grasp that their platform's functional for getting neoliberalism done, but then it kills any hope or faith in the party who carried out those things.
But then the problem is the base doesn't necessarily have anywhere else to go. In that case, there was the alliance formed, which was kind of a social democratic third party that ended up going to coalition with Labour. And then anyway, this is New Zealand political history.
But yeah, that sounds very similar to how things went probably just a couple years off from how things were in the 90s with under Clinton. Then Obama was just a repeat of that. Hillary Clinton would have got in. It would have just been like that, or if even Buttigieg. But, you know, it's just like they don't grasp that their politics is extinct. And that's why they keep losing, that their kind of governance and politics and stuff just is not going to work in this time point. And same thing with the conservatives. That's why, you know, conservatives are unleashing fascism. They don't need to function. They don't need to be successful or have demographics. They just want a one-party fascist state and a theocracy. Altmaier and other people say, you know, fascist dictatorships, they only need about 20% of the population. You look at Trump, the Republicans, I mean, the GOP that's gone fascist, the numbers, it's about 30%, about right, sounding on schedule.
Yeah, yeah. So we were talking about the neoliberal parties losing their base, and like my learning about Labour's history in relation to those kind of reforms was definitely part of my becoming kind of radicalized. And actually, even the social democrats at my university, even they were taught that and were aware of that. They just believed that Labour could be brought back to being a social democratic party. I became a sect Marxist, and essentially the starting point, I would say, for, you know, my political thinking, even though I'm critical of the things I've said and done as a sect Marxist, it is kind of the starting point almost of my politics ever since, like whether I'm critical of aspects of it or still stick to other aspects of it, it's kind of foundational. I think the biggest thing about the kind of Marxism that I learnt during that period that I've since broken from is that it had a critique of imperialism that was very centered on the United States. And this was before the Arab Spring, and it was coming out of the global financial crisis and before the Arab Spring. So I sort of learnt this model of Marxism that had a critique of imperialism, was very focused on the US and everything bad has had the US at its root kind of thing.
I definitely had that belief.
Yeah. I think on the sort of radical left, I think it was pretty much the default position and maybe still is. But in any case, it was kind of the Arab Spring. I didn't immediately see how this changed everything. I saw that the revolutions were a big deal, but I didn't sort of think about it in relation to my conception of imperialism or anything like that. Instinctively, I supported people fighting dictators regardless of what side of the geopolitical line they were on. You know, I was supporting people fighting for democracy, whether the dictators were on the Russian side or the US side, the Chinese side. Like, that made sense to me. And it took me a number of years to kind of really start to think about what that meant in relation to the kind of model of imperialism that I had, that was very centered on one country rather than a kind of global system that essentially all countries are implicit in. But yeah, it took me a number of years to basically start to learn about in more depth about things like the Syrian Revolution and why there were a lot of leftists who sort of hadn't supported the Syrian Revolution. It didn't take me long to see that people fighting for democracy is good regardless of what side of the geopolitical line they were on.
I would say the same thing on that end. And it also talking to people who knew people or dealt with people who were refugees, either in Egypt or Syria, and people who had come out west to the West, gotten the hell out of these countries when the hammer was dropped by these dictators, and just hearing the difference and how complicated and complex and nuanced these histories and these stories were, and to go back and read about some of the histories of really what led up to these moments, and just seeing how the left has a pretty bankrupt assessment of these things. They're just like, Gaddafi good, oh, we go, there's a regime change against Assad, therefore we should support Assad. And then I just looked at that critically. I was like, they dropped the plans for a regime change against Assad under Obama. Why keep saying that there's plans for imperialist plans for regime change? It doesn't make sense. Yeah, it only makes sense if you're doing propaganda for Assad in Russia. But same thing with Libya, you know, it was like, fuck Gaddafi. He wasn't a fucking communist, you know, and he was working along with the war on terror. He was letting his country, just like Assad was, being used as black sites for the CIA to rendition and torture people that they're kidnapping from around the world.
It's not become a conspiracy theory, but yeah.
I always thought it was strange when I saw back in, I think 2003 or something, during the early protests, you know, before going into Iraq or something around those times, that when I saw like International Answer and some of these other people looking into their politics, then suddenly like supporting dictators and shit. And I remembered this in the 90s being a lot of schisms on the left, with some people on the left supporting Slobodan Milosevic and Srebrenica and Chomsky on that issue, and other people talking about Bosnia and Yugoslavia and the different ethnic cleansing and whether or not there were genocides and stuff. So I saw a lot of these splits coming up definitely back then, and found it strange and was more interested in learning about what people in the Balkans had to say about the different issues. Then I saw how, okay, these are a bunch of LaRouches mostly on the left have taken over, and campists and stuff that are just like, we're just pro, you know, Milosevic because he's not America. That just really rubbed me the wrong way. And just the more I saw like how people like the British or the Scottish MP Galloway, he was like friends with Saddam Hussein and saying how great Saddam was and all that. I was just like, the fuck? I came to those conclusions about campism and imperialism, and at the right time, because I think I shudder to think that, you know, when I look at the people on Twitter and Facebook, and I was like, look at people on Twitter who are saying that all these bombings in Mariupol and all these places in Kiev and the cities in Ukraine. Oh, those didn't happen. That's just Western propaganda. This is really Western imperialism because, you know, they're trying to force Ukraine into NATO or something. And it's just like so naked now at this point that how wrong these positions are and how thoroughly infiltrated the left in this country and many others is by these imperialist powers. We went from COINTELPRO infiltrating much of the left to now having all these other foreign powers doing it too. I mean, we've always had Russians at different levels, especially the Soviet Union, infiltrating, you know, Communist Party politics in America. Never to the degree, of course, that McCarthyists thought they were under every bed, but to deny it is stupid too and partisan.
Well, I don't know if infiltration is really the word. They were explicitly affiliated.
People were taking orders. There were also sleeper cells here. Let's not pretend there weren't.
There's also the fact that anti-communism essentially forced a lot of communists to be covertly communist, that people were forced to hide their beliefs, essentially.
Yeah. And it's like they used to say in the 60s that, you know, the CPUSA, it was half the party is like FBI agents, the other half is FBI agents. But anyway, I wanted to think about how other politics have evolved of like before it got into seeing hierarchy in the state and capitalism itself as a problem. A lot of things kind of fell into place and a lot of things evolved. But so, of course, being liberal on immigration, I was a bit of a swerf actually as a feminist, and it makes sense for a lot of people when you're a liberal, when you look at prostitution, you know.
I mean, speaking of, I was into Germaine Greer in high school as well, incidentally. Not specifically her transphobic work. I was a fan of Germaine Greer. If you read her stuff, almost quite libertarian itself, because she was one of the second wave feminists who was more at the sort of sexual freedom kind of rhetorical end of the scale. That sort of dovetailed with my sort of libertarianism at the time, so I was a Germaine Greer fan.
Yeah, for me, being more into third wave feminism after a point, in the 90s, I lightened up and started having a more enlightened view on sex work. And then by now, I'm like pro-sex worker, you know, and everything and all that. Whereas some people on the left are still swerfs. And, you know, you scratch a swerf, you find a TERF, and you find a fascist.
Which is how I got to Germaine Greer.
Exactly. Yeah, I was just going to say for that, I just kept moving left across the 90s and everything to becoming more of a democratic socialist. I think I've always consistently had the same environmental ideas, just getting better and better at it and being more concise. I would say, if anything, I had a bad idea or a dodgy idea was maybe Gaia theory, considering that be true. But thankfully, I was never a primitivist. I would say, ironically, as I moved away from religion, you know, I jumped out of the Catholic Church because first it was pissing me off how they treated the Inquisition and how they treated the whole pre-Columbian invasion stuff and Columbus and how they act like nothing was wrong, you know, and didn't take any responsibility for the child molestations and sex problems everywhere, the Magdalene dryers, Magdalene laundries and all these things around the world. For me as a Catholic, I kind of felt like at first, before I started seeing the bad problems pile up, most Catholics in America are very liberal. I mean, the majority are pretty much pro-choice. You know, most Catholic women in this country use birth control. We like the Pope, but he's kind of like, he's our mascot. Is the way it's looked at, you know? For me, I was proud of Vatican II. We had that over the Protestants as far as the born-agains that I was around in Oklahoma when I saw the birth of the evangelical religious right that we have, prosperity gospel people that are taking over the country. When I was a kid, that was new. Part of that. And I was unfortunately in Ground Zero, where Oral Roberts University and Rima Bible Academy, my stepmom was a teacher there, was the student. I've even been on the Oral Roberts campus and has big giant hands praying that are in bronze. Being around that and seeing how the difference of, yeah, I'm not into the talking in tongues and the hating people and being prejudiced. As a Catholic, I'm like, well, Catholics recognize science, recognize evolution, recognize that there could be intelligent life in the universe just as much as any scientists would make the argument pro or con. And it was like, just believe in God is above all and stuff, but it's not in a creationist way. They reject creationism. And I thought that that was a good thing. So it's not like fundamentalism, not like Adam and Eve in the ways of that was literally true or Noah's Ark or something, you know? So for me, I kind of felt like that was a little more enlightened. So I was like, hey, the more bad stuff that piled up and the more they acted like the Inquisition was a good thing and the Crusades and stuff like this. And then now the not taking responsibility for shit that's happening 30 years ago. And now it was just enough was enough for me. Oh, it was just logically looking at it. But, you know, at least, God, at least I didn't totally become the prototypical, stereotypical, angry atheist, new atheist type. You know, I just missed that by a smidge.
Yeah, one side of my family is Catholic and it's much the same. I've never had them Bible bashing about or anything like that. They just Catholic by default. Mm-hmm. That's just the thing they happen to be raised.
Luckily, I was an atheist before that stuff. I think if I became an atheist then, I would have been stuck going down that road before getting out of that road.
I rejected that also. I did go through a very short-lived Dawkins phase, but it was actually more the selfish gene, strangely, that I was into.
Yeah. For me, I was already flirting with like Zen Buddhism and Taoism, and then by then I was starting to be more Taoist. So for me, I was starting to throw the whole Trinity out for me.
Atheism to me was always too obvious to need a movement in a way. I was raised in a family that didn't go to church. I was never really raised religious at all. Atheism was never that much of a revelation to me. So to encounter these people who are so militantly atheist, like I think I could understand it more if it was about, say, resisting homophobic religion within your community or something. If it was more about people resisting the problems of organized religion in their communities, that would be one thing.
Well, they can't now. That's the big problem of why I'm so against the church now. Because now they're going on an excommunication spree, and that's really saddened me.
Just on the new atheists. With a lot of new atheists, it comes off as quite detached from those problems. For example, you know, there are the nuns who've challenged like sexism within the Catholic Church and are completely detached from all that. I guess my point is the new atheists, they're actually much in the same position that I was in, which is that they're not really that affected by religion. Mm-hmm. So I don't see why it matters to them so much.
Yeah, for me, I would say, unless you were in a Jehovah's Witness family or a really harsh Catholic or lived in the Bible Belt and was in a repressive born-again family, that you really weren't that oppressed, you know, per se. I mean, it just depends. Unless you're on the out religion, if you're Jewish or somebody, or Muslim or an atheist, that's in the deep south, maybe, that we still have it so much better. I mean, it's on a sliding scale. I mean, between like being an atheist and more agnostic or less religious or more spiritual here versus, I don't know, Iran or Saudi Arabia being your worst case scenario. We've seen how Europe got to go more secular. Ironically, the Puritans evolved into Unitarians here. Speaking of which, the irony for me is, as an atheist, somebody that really got through to me intellectually and spiritually was seeing Bishop John Shelby Spong on Bill Moyer's show on PBS, and they were talking about God and stuff and religion, and on Bill Moyer's, and now this guy was a pretty renegade Anglican here, or Episcopalian. He was a non-theist Christian. I mean, square that circle. He didn't even believe there was a God. God was a person or whatever, personified or whatever you call it. And that's why I became one. As more of a Taoist and more of an atheist. See, philosophical Taoism, which I've always leaned towards, is secular. But like, if you wanted to take it in a religious direction, I mean, you'd be in more of a Spinoza territory.
You're a member of the Unitarian Universalists, aren't you? I have been.
Yeah. For me, when I learned about it and got involved, I was like, God damn it, why didn't I know that this was in Oklahoma and other states I lived in? Because like, this would have saved so much time. I met so many people that were in mixed religion families that became Unitarians, and it was so much easier. I was like, wow. You know, being around religious people in a religious tradition that can be even irreligious, where it's not a negative thing of making you feel like you're going to hell for taking a shit or jerking off or getting married or something. I don't know what the hell, like in Catholicism, you know?
I played a Unitarian Universalist in a high school play. I learned about Unitarian Universalism. Mum was a militantly lapsed Catholic, so she always raised us with basically the idea that the Catholic Church instills this like guilt in people that she was very much against. Like she would always play us Marian Faithful's guilt and say that that described the Catholic Church pretty well. I think I was raised in such a sort of atheist-leaning environment that in a way, new atheism never made sense to me.
And I would say if, had I not gone into this, had I not listened to Spong's message, he just died this year. I didn't even notice. Nobody made a big thing about it until recently. It really got across to me. And then becoming a Unitarian and being around people, different faiths and no faith and pagans, that really helped me to not be an asshole as an atheist and just recognize that, you know, I may completely disagree and think that these people are wrong as hell and the fundamentalists and stuff, but like not getting into the dehumanization territory necessary and not being so stupid and uncurious to thinking all religion is the same. It just, oh, religion just tells you why the sun comes up and down. Well, different religions have different purposes. That's something that a lot of people have pointed out in the failings of New Atheism, is that its fundamental misunderstanding or inability or not even caring to understand how religion functions and what it means for people. And I have the same argument for fundamentalists in that who try to make everything like creationism and based out of the Bible. And it's like, you know, science versus religion. And like you see it in stupid movies like Prometheus, they couldn't even make the argument right. The way I look at it as the way you answer that argument is that science and religion are asking and answering completely different questions, and they're in completely different territories.
That's like Stephen Jay Gould's non-overlapping magisteria, right?
Yeah. He was very impressed by anarchism, and if not an anarchist himself, he was influenced by Kropotkin quite a bit. And yeah, Kropotkin definitely sealed the deal for me.
He's also very influenced by Marxism. Like his approach to evolution was drawn dialectics, and like it was a conscious
influence. Yeah. It was such a shame that we lost him and were stuck with such a hate monger like Dawkins. You know, who's an Islamophobe and a turf.
We lost Douglas Adams as well, who was one of Dawkins' good friends, and I feel like was just a much more relaxed intellectual figure.
He might have talked them down if he still lived, you know?
Yeah, I feel like he could have been a moderating influence on Dawkins.
Yeah. And what's weird for me is that spiritual evolution tied into, dovetailed with my political evolution in ways I didn't think about till much later, but I started noticing it. The more I learned about the connections between Taoists who have been anarchists, Taoist anarchism and Chinese anarchism and everything, the more I learned about these different historical permutations, just like there's been primitive communism, like the Diggers and the Levelers and other groups, that in the English Civil War, you know, certain ideas and a lot of thinkings have through lines through history where a lot of different people who didn't know each other come to a lot of the same conclusions and then read about the other ideas and then they're influenced, you know, and it carries forward. So for me, Taoism really was like a gateway to anarchism. You know, getting into listening to Alan Watts all the time, who was a libertarian, but his social libertarianism, I think, really helped. So here, a libertarian actually helped me get away from libertarianism in the right way. So I would say for my politics changing, you know, I didn't like get radicalized, to say that, as much as I hate saying that word, it needs to be a better word for it than what lines up with what the state says.
Particularly considering it's also used for being radicalized to the right, but yeah.
Yeah, and or to terrorism, to be an ISIS. But what I would say is, seeing the IMF World Trade Organization stuff, learning about how that was wielded on people, learning about the ALT globalization movement, even seeing how right-wingers were trying to infiltrate it back then too. Just like with the eco-fascists, there was eco-fascists trying to get into that. But then learning about left politics and the World Social Forum, and then started following all that stuff and learning about that politics. And then I was watching stuff about the battle in Seattle and the protests there. I was learning more about these anarchists that are there. I guess I'm so oppositional that I'm like, who are these anarchists I'm supposed to hate and fear and think are stupid or whatever? And the rioters. I looked up a lot of that stuff. I saw how even the police chief, who's the chief of police in Seattle, has condemned the whole thing. That really had a big impact on my political evolution of kind of moving in the direction of more explicit democratic socialism by 2000, and then really seeing that through of like, well, you know, just like think it's religion and coming to the conclusion, well, if there is a God, clearly the Trinity's bullshit or doesn't have to be true, and being a Unitarian or being a Universalist that, well, if God is good, then why would he create a hell? Logically, you can't reform capitalism away until you get to socialism. And I didn't have the best understanding of the state and hierarchy yet. But like, I was thinking about that and I was thinking, well, because I was looking at the politics of the Sock Dem parties in Europe and I was seeing how they all just fell back into Blairism and stuff, neoliberalism. And I was just thinking, obviously, you know, socialism, it clearly is the better way to organize your society or full communism. I came to the conclusion that democratic socialism or whatever leaves capitalism in place. Then it would leave capitalism and hierarchy and patriarchy and the state in place because you can't vote those away either. So I was like looking more at, okay, so I'm definitely leaning left, never had a problem with communism, never a red baiter. I was looking at the 20th century history of state socialism. I was thinking that, you know, looking at all the ways that Cold War went and USSR went and all the other countries that were communist in name only, I thought about definitely a problem with tactics. Well, if you want a classless, stateless communism, why don't you just go straight to a classless, stateless communism using anarchism or something like along those lines and use consummate ends? Have your means and ends mean the same? Because I came to that conclusion as I was looking more and more into anarchism, realizing that that's a very important part of anarchism, the ethics, that you can't force and drag other people into freedom. You can't force a communist, stateless, non-capitalist society where everybody's free into being using the tactics of the state, using the tactics of terrorism and everything unethical. You know, if you're supposed to be saying, okay, we'll put away those unethical things once we achieve it. Because he saw every revolution, not to be reactionary in that regard, revolution becomes its worst enemy. But, you know, there is some truth in that. But the reason is not because you have revolutions. The problem is the fucking tactics. And the problem is if you justify any means to get utopia or to get those goals, I mean, it doesn't take a political scientist or reactionary or anybody to come to the conclusion that I say I'm going to create utopia, but like, follow me, put me in charge. Let's kill all the right people. Yeah, of course a cult or sect is going to fucking do that. We have the example of the Bolsheviks doing exactly that after hoping they wouldn't, after it looking like maybe they won't for a while. They fucking betrayed the revolution. And so it's like, how many times does it have to happen in so many countries? And you get this kind of, you know, fucked up Soviet Union doing capitalism wrong. And then now we have China doing capitalism even better than America and being authoritarian and fascist at the same time. It's not Marx's fault. It's not the theory's fault. It seems to be the application by the people who are not getting it. I see the 20th century as a massive waste of fucking time. Once the Russian Revolution was successful, everybody just threw all the other Marxist theories, threw anarcho-syndicalism, anarchism, everything else out the window, and decided what we need to do is a repeat of Russia. And instead, nobody learned any lessons. Nobody did the correct critique except for the smarter people. And we got Russia, we got Cuba, we got Vietnam, we got North Korea, which is now devolved, and now China is capitalist and autocratic. Let's not pretend to play the game anymore and just believe in, say that I believe in a thing and do the things consistent and go there. Bring that world about for figurative politics. I think once you see hierarchy as the problem, you have a better view of how to do a dictatorship of the state correctly, I would say, or how to deal with the problem of dissolving the state or getting rid of the state in the end there. Well, you can't plan all this shit ahead of time because the changing conditions of the moment are going to be different in every moment when you get there. So if you have a battle plan and you have a plan for how you get to capitalism, if the one thing doesn't fit that and you try to force everything else, you're just as bad as any reactionary or religious nut.
So we're going to have to wrap this up in some way.
So yeah, that's why that made more sense. And I think Chomsky and Zinn helped me with that. And I just kept learning and reassessing and coming to better conclusions or maybe realizing what past conclusions were still good by learning about anarcho-feminism, like I said, got away from the swerfism. Queer theory helped big time, I would say. Everybody needs to get into their intersectional theories, and you will start moving away from any kinds of reactionary ideas you currently have, and you'll start shedding them and start moving and taking on some better ones, better ideas as you go. Crip theory on disability has helped me as a disabled person. Decolonization has helped me really go back, as with the Black anarchism, to go back and think about my ideas on Black nationalism that I used to have as a hotep and see, oh, where I was way wrong, and see how far Pan-Africanism has actually come in a good direction and African anarchism and Black African anarchism has gone. See how this and abolitionism, all these things have just really expanded my understanding. And I say that not only is that truism so-called about a liberal when you're young, conservative when you're old, I would say if you live long enough, you have the potential to become more open-minded, more open-hearted. You can go further to the left or whatever, become more revolutionary.
Yeah, I think we're kind of faced with this global system. You know, you could call it colonial capitalism. There's these interlocked problems to do with, you know, the gender division of labor. So the way that women's labor is devalued while men's labor is exploited. Even so, all of these things are interlocking and global and, you know, are just as much the case really in China or Russia as they are in the USA in broad terms, the sense that there's the same basic system with sort of regional variations in how it's enforced, and sort of come to a somewhat convergent kind of view that all of these unjust hierarchies need to be dismantled, which for me follows from Marx's thought. But if for someone else it follows from Bakunin, I don't feel like that has to be an unbridgeable chasm. The important thing is the political conclusions we've drawn with this global interlocking system that needs to be fought on all fronts, essentially.
And maybe we're all right because it's only logical and it's correct, irregardless of who comes to the conclusion.
I guess we can wrap up by saying we're now absolutely correct about everything. And if you come back in 10 years, there will be absolutely nothing that we were wrong about because we've reached the apotheosis of correctness. I think that can be the conclusion. We are now right about everything.
I'm afraid now. Oh, this has me very self-conscious now because I'm thinking, five years, it's going to look pretty bad.
I guess the wary note to end on is we've probably still got things to learn and oversight, and that is life, you know, just to end on a somewhat ambivalent note.
And maybe 42 is the answer to life after all.
Was it that the right question? In any case, yes.
I think I wrapped it and both of us wrapped that up very well.
I'll do a bit of a wrap up. Thanks for listening to our rambling confessionals. I'm hoping that this helps others on their sort of path. None of us are born libertarian communists. In any case, you can support our work at Patreon at patreon.com/jetpack1917. Good night and good luck.
And we'll see you in the future.
moans alone while I sit under a tree.